This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. And my next guest is Jose Luis Bermudez, an author and professor of philosophy and liberal arts at Texas A&M University. His new book is called Frame It Again, New Tools for Rational Decision-Making. It's a thorough and broad study of the way frames, essentially how we think about things, from the political to the personal, shape our thinking, decisions, and behavior. And he says by better understanding framing, we can make better decisions. Jose Luis Bermudez, welcome to The 21st.
Oh, Brian, it's great to be with you.
Thank you for being here. So I want to begin with a definition of framing. And I mean, you explicitly say in your book that you have avoided a sort of what are frames chapter because, you know, the concept means so many different things and so many different concepts. So maybe we can narrow it down by sort of thinking it's election day. Can you tell us in the political context, what is a frame?
A frame is a way in which people sort their experience by making one feature of it, one aspect, one dimension, particularly salient, and using that as a lens through which they see the whole. So it's really a way of fastening onto one feature of a complex, multidimensional process.
And maybe we can be even more specific here by thinking of some examples in a political context, right? We think of Republicans rebranding the estate tax as the death tax. And we know Democrats are out there trying to rebrand gun control to instead talk about gun safety. Are these are examples of this phenomenon?
These are examples of framing. And I think one of the themes of my book is that a lot of the things that we talk about as values issues are really framing issues. And you've given some great examples, and other examples that spring to mind are climate change, abortion. These are all things where the framing, the presentation, the focus varies across different perspectives and drives really different approaches.
And we need to take a break in about a minute here. But before that, I do want to ask about some frames that have come up in recent, this year in particular, in terms of politics. One of them is defunding the police, right? Which is a frame through which people look at police violence and talk about what they would like to see done. Is that how do you think, what sort of values come through when somebody says defund the police is their mode of responding to that particular crisis?
I think it's a really bad frame.
Okay.
I think that's not a helpful and constructive way of framing the issues if you're trying to promote a discussion that's going to move forwards and sort of bring people under a single umbrella, because it's an extremely confrontational way of putting things, and it's also very loosely defined. And one of the problems with having frames that are very loosely defined is that people can interpret them however they wish. And what we've seen with the defunding the police frame is that people have read into it an extremism that is not perhaps there in all of its advocates.
Yeah. Okay. We need to take a break here, and we're going to continue our conversation on framing the political and the personal with Jose Luis Bermudez. His book is Frame It Again, New Tools for Rational Decision Making. This conversation will continue after a short break here on The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jose Luis Bermudez, who's an author and professor of philosophy, and also the Samuel Ray Gammon Professor of Liberal Arts at Texas A&M University. We're talking about his new book, Frame It Again, New Tools for Rational Decision Making. It's about how frames, essentially how we think about things, can affect our thinking, our decisions, our behavior in both a political context and in our personal lives as well, with something as challenging for many of us as trying to exercise more or change the way we eat, keeping New Year's resolutions, that kind of thing. And we're going to come to that idea a little later in our conversation, but we're beginning with the sort of idea of political framing. And one of the big ideas in your book is that while framing has been used to stoke political divisions, we mentioned before the break, you know, is it gun control or gun safety? Is it the estate tax or the death tax? One of the ideas in your book is that framing can become a tool for cooperation to perhaps get beyond polarization. You write that framing is an important source of what you call discursive deadlock. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to paraphrase that for a lay audience as kind of political gridlock. But one of the problems is that they're not very good at seeing how abstract values can be applied to the same thing. So what does that mean?
Yeah, well, thanks very much for bringing that up. And thanks also for reading my book so carefully. That was a great presentation. So the basic idea that I have is that a lot of what we think of as clashes about values are really clashes of frames. I mean, there are very few people that are going to stand up and say that they are against freedom or that they're against fairness or they're against justice. But where the rubber really hits the road is in how people frame particular situations as instances of fairness or as instances of justice. And I think this is in some ways a very positive way of thinking about things, because it opens up the possibility of trying to think your way into other people's way of framing things. And that's a lot easier than trying to change your values. So let me give you an example. I mean, many ways of framing things are fixed by the media, by the kind of images that are presented, by the things that people take to symbolize particular states of affairs. And I think that one possibility that people need to think much more about is trying to think their way into other people's ways of framing issues by trying to expose themselves to images and people and presentations that other people find persuasive, and try and perform this really complicated feat of simultaneously holding different perspectives on one very complicated phenomenon, and recognizing that when things get complicated, there aren't single right answers. There are just multiple perspectives, each of which contains a grain and sometimes more than a grain of truth.
And often those perspectives, while they're different sort of on the surface issue, on the surface level of, you know, how you might list it on a list of issues that voters care about, that ultimately, when you drill down deep enough, the same value underpins them. And one of the examples in your book is, say, a political candidate who says that students should have the option to give the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag in a school. And you talk about how somebody who has been raised in America might have one view of that and pledging allegiance to the flag, and somebody raised in a European context would have a different view. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think the Pledge of Allegiance is really interesting because, well, for many reasons. One of them is that a lot of the rhetoric around the Pledge of Allegiance is actually framing the pledge in terms of some sort of fidelity to the founding ideals of America. And I think a lot of people think that the Pledge of Allegiance is somehow, if not part of the Constitution, somehow really closely linked to it. But actually, the Pledge of Allegiance is a very specific frame on what America is. It was written in 1892 by a clergyman and socialist who was very concerned about immigration, and he wrote it as an affirmation of a particular white Protestant approach to America. When he wrote it, it didn't contain the words "one nation under God." That was added in 1954 under pressure from the Knights of Columbus. So we have this social phenomenon, complex thing that is really polarizing for a lot of people. But I think it's really important to recognize that pledge itself is the result of very complex types of framing. And I think understanding some of the things that have gone into it will I think weaken some of the reactions that people have to it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, and you write about, for some complicated issues such as the abortion issue, it's basically impossible to come up with a neutral frame. What do you mean by that?
So the issue is that our language is loaded. And this is something that's been brought out by some of the people who've studied frames, like the cognitive linguist George Lakoff. It's very hard to find a language that will describe things in completely frame neutral or value neutral ways. So I was thinking about this morning when I was thinking about different ways that people frame leadership in the presidential election, and I was having real difficulty finding a way of describing the leadership style of one candidate that wasn't sort of loading the bases in my description. So, for example, you know, I didn't want to use words like bluster or insulting. So eventually I came up with the word hyper-assertive, which is as close as I can get to a neutral description of one of the candidate's leadership style. But still, that's not totally neutral. And then with abortion, it's very hard to find a neutral description because the whole phenomenon is bound up with what you think about the act of abortion. Do you think of it as killing a thing? Do you think of it as killing a person? Do you think of it as not killing anything but a medical procedure? However you describe it, you are taking one particular stand. If you describe it as a simple medical operation, that's a stand, because you're not describing it in the ways that some people think you ought to be describing it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, as a journalist, we are trained to not use, you know, the most popular terms to express those values by people who are on one side of that issue or the other are saying one is pro-life or pro-choice. As a journalist, I've been trained not to use those frames and to try and refer to it as neutrally as possible. So we tend to say people who favor abortion rights or people who oppose abortion. But I suppose, as you're pointing out, that if you look at the values underpinning them, I suppose people who are on the favoring abortion rights side, the pro-choice side, in their construction are pro-life because they say, well, sometimes it's necessary to protect the life of the woman to have abortion rights. And the other side would say, well, we're pro-choice because we believe this unborn child should have a choice, to live their life. So how does one sort of break through and dig into trying to understand what the values are that underlie these frames?
Well, you have to think yourself into the other side, as it were. I mean, it's unusual to find someone who's completely neutral. So you'll probably be skewing in one direction or another. And then you have to expose yourself as much as possible to the kind of things that form the identity and the framing of the people who disagree with you. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And there are limits to how far you can go. I mean, there are some people who write about frames and they imply that really everything's a frame and that there's no way of getting beyond the frame to the facts of the matter. As Nietzsche said, there are no facts, only interpretations. And that's a pretty dangerous view, and I don't hold with that. There is a certain factual framework that needs to be respected by everyone in the debate. It's a fact, for example, that the Pledge of Allegiance was written in 1892. It's a fact that a fetus has a heartbeat at a certain number of days. It's not a fact that a fetus is a person. It's not a fact that the Pledge of Allegiance represents the core values of the American Constitution. So finding that line between the factual issues where you have to be right and then the framing issues where you have to be sensitive to people's perspectives and try and understand those and try to find common ground, that's a very important line to find. And it seems to me that in a lot of contemporary debates, that's just kind of been lost.
You know, one of the issues that's become so salient this year is the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's become politicized. And I wonder how much of that, in your view, has to do with the way it's been framed. And can you imagine a way out of the situation we're in, where the act of, you know, wearing masks and, you know, not attending large gatherings, things like that, has become something that people think of through their political affiliations as much as public health? Do you see a role for your conception of how people can reframe things to behave more rationally in our response?
Yeah, but you might think it's sort of utopian. I mean, I think running through a lot of these issues, the gun control, gun safety, masks, no masks, flag, no flag kind of issues, is really a conflict between two different ways of framing the value of freedom. And you can frame freedom at the level of the individual, or you can frame it at the level of society. So you can kind of have a vision of freedom as an absence of personal restrictions. You know, heck no, I don't need to wear a mask. I don't need to do this. I can, you know, drive whatever vehicle I want, making whatever amount of noise I want. That's how I understand freedom, is in terms of absence of personal restrictions. Or you can understand freedom as a free society. And you can think of a society as free when there's a balance between individual spheres of personal liberty and collective goods and collective order that make it possible for individuals to flourish. And if people don't start thinking about freedom in that second way, then it's going to be really tough to find a common grounds on mask wearing or gun control or anything.
So you have to want to find the common ground.
You have to want to find the common ground. But the funny thing is that there are plenty of places where people do find that common ground, and they do have that vision of a collective free society. So down where I live in rural Texas, we're pretty big on hunting. I don't know anybody, you know, the most diehard personal freedom supporters, all perfectly happy to accept that you need to get a hunting permit before you go out and shoot deer. The hunting season starts this weekend in Texas. So there's a sort of strange disconnect between people being prepared to think about collective goods and social goods in one context, but not being prepared to think about them in another. And one of the challenges, I think, but also the opportunities, is to try and get people to see similarities between different situations, where they accept one way of framing in one situation, and then ask them, well, why are you not prepared to accept that in a different framing, in a different situation?
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating topic. I did say to our listeners we would be able to talk a little bit about framing in the context of self-control, but unfortunately we are almost out of time, so I don't think we're going to be able to do that. If listeners are interested in learning more about that, you know, this idea of competition between short-term rewards and long-term rewards, and how different frames can maybe help reorient our thinking on, do we have that drink now versus, you know, waking up with a hangover in the morning? Do we have the, you know, do you sleep in for the hour in the morning versus being healthy in our later years in life? There's so much more to think about here, but unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We will have a link to Jose Luis Bermudez's book, Frame It Again, New Tools for Rational Decision Making, at our website, 21stshow.org. Professor Bermudez teaches at Texas A&M in philosophy and liberal arts. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Really enjoyed it.
And that is all the time we have for today. I do want to remind our listeners that on, I think, pretty much most of the NPR stations where you are hearing this show, there will be live election coverage beginning tonight at 6 p.m. from NPR in Washington, and then we'll be adding in local coverage starting at 7 on most of these stations. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan is our engagement producer, and our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantal Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I want to remind our listeners you can find our past conversations on topics like the graduated income tax and everything else going into this election season. If you need help making a decision, that's on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.